If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Before taking questions from reporters today, President Trump said that his great relationship with French President Emmanuel Macron was not fake news, but added that his fake relationship with Melania is not great news.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with Desus Nice and the Kid Mero of the comedy duo Desus and Mero. They also take a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. Then, as a special bonus, singer Lily Allen sits down for an exclusive podcast interview with Late Night producer Sarah Jenks Daly and talent executive Jeremiah Silva. But first, let's go to Seth.
President Trump's firing of former Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin last month sparked a debate about whether or not Trump will move to privatize the VA. So how concerned should we be, and has Trump made good on his promise to fix the VA in general? It's time for the check-in. President Trump has an idea how to fix some of the problems at the Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare system. See if you can spot the one word he thinks will make all the difference.
We're going to have choice, and we are now doing choice.
We are going to ensure every veteran in America has the choice to seek care at the Veterans Administration or to seek private medical care.
We want them to have choice.
Choice is the word Republicans use when they mean privatization, because there's this mindset on the right that the private sector can do everything better than the government can. There's a debate to be had, but I'll just say that the Hoover Dam has been there for almost 90 years, while the Jamba Juice on your block that used to be a Curves is now a Chipotle. Trump talks about this idea of choice like he came up with it, but in reality, the Veterans Access Choice and Accountability Act has been in place since 2014. You know, back when your Chipotle was a Radio Shack. Now, among other things, the act allows veterans to seek private care if they live too far from the VA facility or have to wait too long to get an appointment. But even with that choice, studies have shown that veterans overwhelmingly prefer to go to the VA for their care. But unfortunately, when it comes to decisions involving veterans, Trump reportedly seeks the advice of Fox News personality and Iraq War veteran Pete Hegseth, who favors an overhaul of the VA and who is on Trump's shortlist to be the next Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Now, you might be unfamiliar with Hegseth because you don't watch Fox News, or you're very familiar with him, which means you just hate watching my show, and frankly, I don't appreciate that. So to get you better acquainted, here he is weighing in on issues ranging from the NFL to Charlottesville to the March for Our Lives.
I have to ask you, what are we kneeling for at this point? Because you talk about social injustice. This is the least sexist, least racist, most free, most equal, most prosperous country in the history of humankind. I think the president nailed it. He condemned in the strongest possible terms hatred and bigotry on all sides, as opposed to immediately picking a side out the gate. Forgive me if I don't want a lesson on the Second Amendment from a 16-year-old. Forgive me if I don't want to watch a 9-year-old tell me that her dream is a world without guns. I watched that, and you know what my reaction was? Honestly, I donated to the NRA this morning. I'm serious.
No one thinks you're not serious. But here's where I'm serious. I hope you're better with a gun than you are with an axe. This is an actual clip of Pete Hegseth.
Plus, Pete and Clayton are facing off. They're testing their skills with the axe. Who's going to win this battle with the lumberjack? I'm putting my money on Clayton.
It's like the saying go, the only thing that stops a bad guy with an axe is a drum kit. Now, both Hegseth and the White House deny that Trumps want to privatize the VA, but it's difficult to take that argument seriously because Trump floated the idea of privatization shortly after he was elected. If the VA were privatized, it would only benefit a select few, like big hospitals and providers, at the expense of taxpayers and veterans themselves. And these concerns were heightened after Trump's former VA Secretary David Shulkin said he was fired because he refused to go along with privatizing the VA.
Shulkin alleged today he was fired because he did not want to privatize VA care, in essence, because he refused to dismantle the VA. He claims he fell victim to a power play by Trump's political appointees. Quote, they saw me as an obstacle to privatization who had to be removed.
The good news for Shulkin is every time Trump removes an obstacle, it comes back as an even bigger obstacle. Trump removed James Comey, Comey wrote a book. Trump removed Michael Flynn, Flynn flipped. If Trump had a mole removed, it would be testifying before Congress a week later. Now, Trump could have chosen a number of qualified people to replace David Shulkin at the VA. Someone who has experience running a massive bureaucracy would have been a good start. But instead, Trump went with White House doctor and Navy Rear Admiral Dr. Ronnie Jackson. That's right, he chose the White House doctor. I guess we should just be happy Trump didn't go with his personal doctor. In case you don't remember, that is for real Trump's personal doctor, Harold Bornstein. Ah, bro. Bro. You got a little PTSD? You need a little hydroponic chronic and 200 cc's of Pink Floyd, baby. Now, Jackson's hearing, during which he was expected to answer questions about privatization, was set for this Wednesday, but lawmakers had postponed it after they had received reports of allegations that Jackson oversaw a hostile work environment as a White House doctor, allowing the overprescribing of drugs, as well as claims that Dr. Ronnie L. Jackson drank too much on the job. And I, for one, am shocked to hear that a 50-year-old man who goes by Ronnie would behave improperly. The only way it's okay to be a 50-year-old man named Ronnie is if you play the jazz flute. Oh, yeah! Dr. Ronnie is in the pocket tonight. Now, Trump was asked about what he thinks Dr. Jackson should do next in light of these allegations, and his response was, as usual, all over the place.
I said to Dr. Jackson, what do you need it for? So we'll see what happens. I don't want to put a man through who's not a political person. I don't want to put a man through a process like this. It's too ugly and too disgusting. If I were him, actually, in many ways, I'd love to be him. But the fact is, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
What do you mean if you were him, you wouldn't do it? You're even less qualified and you did do it. This has been The Check-In. Our guests host the very funny late-night show Desus and Mero, weeknights on Viceland. They're also touring the country with their show Bodega Boys Live. Please welcome back to the show our friends Desus Nice and the Kid Mero. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us back.
I want to start. You guys are doing this live show, and this is a photo you posted. This was you guys doing your show at the Apollo.
At the Apollo.
That is really something else.
That's a sold-out show right there. Our credit went up. 10 points after that show.
Like 100.
Loved it.
Well, you guys, you usually do a podcast, you do a TV show. I've been to your studio, it's wonderful, but you don't have a live audience. How is it different doing the same thing that you guys are used to doing in front of a live audience?
Well, when you're doing a live audience at the Apollo, you can see if people don't like the jokes, and they're right there, so they'll let you know right away.
Look you in the eye like,
like, boo!
Nah.
Yeah, they're very well lit. Oh, there's no guessing what they're thinking.
The last thing you want is to be booed off the Apollo. Man, Sandman comes out, hooks you off.
Luckily, that hasn't happened to us yet, but the good thing about it is that you get immediate response to your jokes. Like, here, like, you say something funny, they laugh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We don't have a studio, and so we're going to get that. But when you do the live show, it's like energy tennis, bro. It's like, yo, I give you energy, you give it back to me. Now I'm excited. I might take my shirt off.
You did the show, you were telling me, in all five boroughs. You've done it in Boston. And when you do it places, you have a lot of, obviously, friends come and support you, family come and support you.
Yeah.
How has that been?
My sister came to the show. I was like, yeah, you had a nice little show.
I would find it funny. His sister comes to the show. I'm like, can't you just see him every other night?
She's like, no, I want to come to the Apollo and sit in the front.
Yes. My thing is, every time we do a show, I find new cousins afterwards. Like, they're just hitting me up. They're like, yeah, I'm your sister's third cousin once removed. I'm like, no.
I live in Connecticut, but you haven't seen me since, 1997.
I want to get your take on this. What do you guys think was going down?
Ooh.
Hey. He's like,
yeah.
He's like, I know Donald's not bringing the heat.
Yeah.
How about your boy? How about your boy?
Oh, man. Melania, you brought an umbrella. Outside is looking a little stormy.
Who knows? They could be talking about the NBA playoffs.
My man Lance Stevenson's gonna go off.
He's gonna go off.
How do you feel, Melania?
Did you see that dunk on Al Horford yesterday? It was incredible.
For three.
Oh, Al Horford, he got bodied. Oh my God. What a poster.
You guys don't. You talk about a lot of stuff on your show, not just politics. But I do want to ask about this because right now Donald Trump obviously has this fear that Michael Cohen might flip on him. Yeah, guys, do you have a take on whether or not Michael Cohen will flip?
He's going to flip so fast.
Oh, my God.
Bro, yo.
He's going to flip before they even put the cuffs on him.
He's young IHOP. That's what I'm going to call him, because he's just going to flip immediately, like, flap.
Could you imagine Michael Cole, like, in the prison yard with the jumpsuit halfway down, pumping iron?
He's not built for that at all.
He does not have a tattoo that says loyalty.
You know what I'm saying? Brotherhood.
It's not happening for him.
America.
So it's a fast flip.
It's a fast flip.
I want to talk to you about something else happening in Washington. Chuck Schumer came out, said he wants to pass some legislation legalizing marijuana on the federal level. Do you think that would be good in general for the country and also Congress? Do you think Congress could use a little weed?
Could you imagine if Congress smoked more weed, how great the names would be on the bills? Instead of being like the Farm Funding Act, it'd be like, yo, let's get cows lit.
Ooh. Yo,
free cheese for pigs. Like, yeah. I'm like, all right.
Yo, Medicare is super popping, bro.
Instead of Obamacare, they call it like, don't die.
Yo, don't die, fam. We'll miss you.
I want to ask, we've talked about Trump before on the show, but Trump is, you guys are now too, you're a New York City institution. Trump was a New York institution for a very long time.
Yeah.
Growing up here, what were your memories of what was Donald Trump?
Growing up, Donald Trump was always how New York, he was like the idea of New York, but if you remember, New York used to be really nasty.
Yeah, so.
A lot of cocaine, a lot of bums in Times Square and stuff. That was Donald Trump's. New York.
Yeah. Donald Trump is New York in the 70s personified.
Yeah.
Times Square in the 70s personified.
If you remember the early episodes of Law and Order, like that's Donald Trump.
When they had like the caprices?
When New York was scary.
Yeah.
You take your family there on vacation.
Yeah. You couldn't go jogging without seeing a body, without seeing a body.
But you just run past by like, another one.
He just started decomposing.
James Comey did a lot of press last week to promote his book. Were you guys upset that you didn't get a shot to interview James Comey?
He's busier than Cardi B right now, man.
He's doing every show. Like, we think he might have a rap album coming out. Like, low-key, if James Comey hopped on a Cardi B remix I would not be shocked.
It would be over.
He's not selling a book. He's trying to get, like, a VH1 special. He's going to be on Love & Hip Hop next season.
Yes. Love & Hip Hop DC. Sorry, James Comey.
That is something to look forward to. Guys, it's always so great to see you. Congratulations. Always a pleasure. Give it up for Jesus Nice and the Kid Marrow. Jesus Marrow airs weeknights on Viceland. For more information for their live tour, visit BodegaSushi.com.
Hey, this is Henry from Late Night, here with Jesus and Mero.
Hey.
We were chatting earlier about how, like, this is your second time on the show. You guys have done a lot of late night talk shows. Mm-hmm. You were just profiled in Vanity Fair. What has it been like, as people who started just with a podcast that are now doing national TV, national publications? It must be super exciting.
Like, the people who started with us initially, when we do the podcast, they see the come up, the trajectory, and they're just like, I feel like a proud dad.
Yeah, like we're always in our Twitter mentions, always like, it's like NBA rookie night. I can't believe how far you guys have come. It's like people younger than us. And I'm so proud of you.
I'm like, you probably could do this too,
I guess. It's still exciting, though. Like, even we got the phone call for this show. We were just like,
word, let's
do it. They're like, do you want to do Seth Meyers? I'm like, excuse me? Like, fam.
Like, yeah,
I'll push my mother out the way to get to 30 Rock.
Who have been your favorite guest on your show?
Oh, man.
Favorite guest. Eric Holder.
Just a few weeks ago, right? He was
Eric
amazing.
Holder. Also, because Eric Holder, not only was he really going to beat the hell out of both of us if we acted up, he also had either Secret Service or FBI agent there who the whole time just had his hand his gun was at. And I was just like, is he going to laugh
or shoot us? Imagine Jason Statham with absolutely no hair whatsoever. Like, no eyebrows, no beard, not laughing or anything.
At the end of it, he's like, that was funny.
That was good, guys.
I was like, that's not killing us.
Great work.
Do you think he genuinely thought it was funny and just was suppressing it the entire time?
He was suppressing it because a couple of times he would laugh and you could see him getting mad at himself for laughing.
He's like, no, I'm supposed to be serious. Like,
he was waterboarding himself at home for 20 years so he didn't have to laugh. He's like, damn, I lost so much.
I lost. I got to go waterboard myself for 20 more years.
That's how I lost a guy in Costa Rica.
For those who haven't seen the show or heard the podcast, how do you explain it to people? Because it's so unique and it's so funny.
You know, the show and the podcast are two different things. The podcast is just like us straight going raw. Not going raw, but going hard for about an hour, 40 minutes. We always say it's like, you know, the straight dope. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's not filtered. There's no legal.
There's no S&P to travel through. You know what I mean? So it's like we just say whatever we want. Right. And we check ourselves. You know what I mean?
We're not wilding out here like that.
Yeah.
But as far as a live show, it feels kind of like a reunion kind of thing because it's like our fans. Our fans might be meeting up with other fans for the first time. Yeah. We do the roll call. And it's just like, it depends. We wing it every night. So it might be, are we going to do
the live
jokes?
Shows too.
The live shows. We never write any jokes for the live shows. So it's like, are we going to do jokes about your city? Or are we just going to do regular jokes? Mm-hmm. It could be whatever. If something happened in the news, we might do like 20 minutes of that.
Yeah, which we sold out Baltimore, Meyerhoff Symphony Hall, shout out to them. And we thought, for some reason, that D.C. and Baltimore were like cool with each other or like the same place or the same region.
And we were totally wrong.
They were like, we hate D.C. D.C. I was like, oh, then we just kept making D.C. jokes and just like egg them on. Like, we're going to go get some mumbo sauce after this.
It's definitely a live show in the fact that the fan, we interact with the fans and the way the fans drive the show, that's where it's going. Because, you know, like the Brooklyn show, I was talking about Uber or whatever. And I was like, yeah, you guys don't know about the Bronx to Brooklyn Uber trips. Like, that's like an $80 ride. And it was one girl in the front was like, talk about it. And I was like, oh, we're going to talk about it now.
We're going to talk about it now.
We're about to do 15 minutes on this.
I put a spotlight on this guy who was smashed. He was like in the third row and he must have hit the bar early
because
he was just sitting there like, yeah. Just leaning. I was like, yup, my man is smacked out of his mind. He was like, yeah.
And when you roast him like that, you go on Twitter later that night. They're like, yo, Miro roasted me, but it was the best time of my life.
I had the best time ever.
You're both super active on Twitter. Do you like checking your mentions or is that?
You know what, the mentions, it's funny about the mentions because mentions are either like people giving you the highest praise that you needed as a child to get a good self-esteem or just people saying the most miserable, random things that shouldn't bother you, but they get in your head and just bother you for like 4 hours. They'll be like, yeah, I love Jesus Miro, but why are Miro's earlobes centered? And you're like...
I'm looking at my earlobes and I'm just looking through like
40 pages of Google images. Like, damn, his ears aren't centered.
Damn. I'm not symmetrical.
Yeah.
I thought I was.
They're like, Jesus, your face doesn't hold up to the golden ratio. I'm like, oh.
Oh my God. What? What does that mean? What? Oh, I got to Google golden ratio. I'm like, oh, God, what does that even mean?
And I write it back. That was a very specific diss. That hurt a lot. You put effort into that.
You're talking about how you win your live shows. What do you do for the Viceline show?
Same thing.
It's a little more produced. But it feels very loose, which is
fine. It's more produced on the producer side.
Yeah.
Which shout out to
them.
They
do all the work.
Because they're putting all this work in. They're like, hey, hey, you guys want to read these transcripts? You guys want to look at these videos?
Just run it. Just run it.
Yeah. They're like, hey, I feel like if you said this joke is a good transition to this next segment, I was like,
just put the facts up there. We'll wing it as we go along.
We've gotten this far by not practicing. We can't change it now.
Yeah. We're like the Allen Iversons of comedy.
Yeah. Even better, I would say, Air Bud. Who was the, remember there was a Rookie of the Year?
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
Oh,
we're the Rookie of the Year.
Yeah.
We broke the arm, but we're just going hard now.
What is Funky Butt Loving? Did he just say Funky Butt Loving? Remember that?
Listen, all you millennials, Google that reference.
Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I love that you're like, thanks for coming on a TV show.
thanks
for coming on this TV show that you got paid for.
Yeah. Up until 3 years ago, the only other TV show we would have been on was Cops. They would have had me on the hood of the car. I'm like, Miro, run, Miro, they don't got you. Just gotta run faster than this one cop.
You see the cop, Matt Fat, running behind me. Almost got him. 10-12, we got a Dominican male hopping the fence.
Run, Miro, he won't get you.
They ain't catching me.
The cameraman's holding him down. Go with freedom.
I just jump on the back of the 40 bus like, yo, we out.
Send me a kite.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm here with Jeremiah Silva, who is a talent executive on our show and who is also responsible for booking our musical guests. One of the guests he booked is Lily Allen, who is with us as well.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
We're very excited because typically we do these backstage interviews with guests on the show. We don't always get to talk to artists who perform. So we're very happy that you are here and you are joining us. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Well, let me just say that I have feel like I've been chasing you to get you here since our show started. So I'm really happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
Great. I'm a huge fan. I'm really excited for the new record. And so thanks for spending some extra time with us.
Yes, oh, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
So the new album is called No Shame. It's out on June 8th. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's great. Congratulations. I wanted to say from listening to it, it did remind me a lot of your first two albums. Mm-hmm. Maybe It's Not Me, It's You more. Mm-hmm. But then I read that that was maybe intentional, that you kind of went back to make this record the way you had made the
stuff
first
before.
Two.
Kind of. I mean, I think I've always had like the same approach to writing music, except for on the third album. And that wasn't really intentional. That was just because I was having a midlife crisis, age 27. But yeah, I think I was like, I had a very clear idea and focus on the first two records, as I did with this one. But on the third record that I did, I just felt like I just had babies. I was like, just not really feeling myself. And I listened to people more than I ordinarily would have done, if that makes any sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
So, like, I don't think I was, like, I wasn't manipulated or, like, pushed into doing anything. I just think I didn't have that conviction in myself. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't quite sure, and I didn't have the confidence to, like, you know, put my money where my mouth was. So I was sort of, like, shopping out for, like, opinions, you know? Like, should I do this? Do you like the sound of this song? What should I wear? Should I wear, you know, and it all started to get a bit messy. And then, you know, this album feels like a little bit of a return to the approach of the first two, because I really was like, okay, what is this job?
Right.
What is it that I want to do? I think also with the third record, you know, there were people that had sort of expectations, like the record company or, you know, management, that, you know, I should sit in the charts where I used to and be on front cover of magazines, etc. And so kind of that became the goal rather than making really good music. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just kind of got a little bit lost in all of that. But this time around, it was like, okay, what do you want to do? I just want to make really good music. Do you want to be a famous pop star? Well, that would be really great if people really liked the music and that came after.
Right,
perfect.
Like icing on the cake.
Yeah, but that's not the primary goal. The primary goal is to make something that I really enjoy, that I think the fans will respect, and that they can hear that, you know, I'm enjoying it. And also something that I can take on the road, because, you know, going out on the road is incredibly repetitive. You know, it can be really lonely and isolating, and if you're not enjoying what you're doing on stage, mm-hmm. that's when you run into real difficulties. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with me last time. So
I think that's interesting, because as a fan, because I'm such a music fan, I go along with the artist on their journey from mm-hmm. album to album, never thinking about that stuff. Mm-hmm. So when I listened to Sheezus, I loved it, like absorbed it, like mm-hmm. listened to everything, and never would have thought anything, except for that's kind of where you were in your life when you were making the record. But saying that, when I listen to it now, I kind of see it in a different way. I also think that a lot of that album was really ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. So, like, especially like Heart Out Here, mm-hmm. like that song right now is so... Mm. It makes so much sense now in the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine like that when you were making it.
No, and actually, I mean, not to blow my own trumpet, but I think I've always been like a little bit ahead of my time, like with the MySpace stuff. And, you know, so much as music is to do with social media now. And honestly, like the last 5-10 years, I've been begging my record company to like give me money to be able to like shoot, you know, behind the scenes stuff and content for my mm-hmm. Instagram. And they're just like, are you mad? Why would we do that? Cut to now. That's literally
everybody's
all anybody
doing
is
that.
Doing. And it was the same thing with MySpace. You know, I wanted to give away my music for free. And I was like, listen, trust me. People will tell you what they like. And then you'll know where to spend your, you know, right. what songs to make a right. video for. Like, it, don't be scared of people listening to stuff first. And they're like, no, you're crazy.
That's
cut
so
to now.
No,
and
that's, everything
and that's exactly what everyone right. does. And also, you know, with songs like The Fear, that couldn't be more relevant now.
I agree.
FU couldn't be more relevant now,
totally.
Even though it's a different president. So yeah, I'm basically Nostradamus. So
that's great. I actually think a lot of the songs on No Shame could be part two-ishes to mm-hmm. some previous songs, like The Fear, where you talk about consumption, all yeah. of that stuff. A lot of the songs on the album now, at least in the beginning of the album, where it feels yeah. more of like that Lily that we know mm-hmm. and then I think the album progresses into a more like positive, always keeping like how cheeky you are, which I think is what the fans love about you yeah. is your turn of phrase and the way that you have a an interesting way of looking at the world and all of that stuff and the way that you write to reflect that, I think, which I think is super cool.
Thank you.
You said that you got a lot of pushback from your record label for the third album. And I read an interview, I think it was with NME, that you did about this is sort of an album where there was less meddling.
Yeah, I mean, I hired a new manager. It's a friend of mine, been a friend of mine for many years, called Seb. In fact, he was my boyfriend many years ago. And he was an A&R man for a major record label for many years. He doesn't do that anymore. He also manages Francis and the Lights. And I just sort of was like, listen, I just want you to be my point of contact. I don't really want to speak to anyone from the record label. Not because I don't like them, but just because I was so wary of like not wanting to take other people's opinions on board and for me to have one person that I had a kind of direct line with.
So you could just be creative.
Exactly. And, you know, and I just kind of kept writing until Seb and me were just like, I think it's done. You know?
So that, do you think that comes with experience of having the breadth of music that you've done or age or a combination of things?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm only as old as I am today, you know, so I can't really tell you whether it's to do with experience or not, but.
It's also probably part of making the third album and not wanting to do that
definitely
again.
Definitely the third album was great experience. Well, it was a terrible experience, but it was also a great experience in a lesson in like what I definitely don't ever want to do again. I don't hate the songs. Like, I actually quite like, you know, I like them. I wouldn't have put them on a record if I didn't, but it was everything around it. And, you know, and music's so visual for me. So when I listen to the music, I just catapulted back to that time and it makes me sad. So, yeah.
The fans love it.
Okay, well, let's change the subject then.
The fans love it.
They do. Especially like, Silver Spoon, I think it's, I found Silver Spoon the way that I found Friday Night on the first album.
Okay.
Like by accident, like it was playing and I was like, what is this song? Mm-hmm. And then I had to go back and learn all the words to Silver Spoon. It's just so clever and cheeky. And I think like you were like speaking back to people that were saying things about you in such a funny way. Anyways, all right, so let's talk about the new album. First, I wanted to talk about Trigger Bang. Mm-hmm. That's the lead single from the album, or would you say?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, this is the other thing, is that there aren't really, like, any, like, singles on it. It's like, I mean, there are, because record companies like to release music in that way, but I kind of wanted to just drop everything at
together.
Once. And, you know, I lost that battle. But, yeah, I guess it was the first song that we serviced to radio. Although, actually, it was a leak. It was a mistake. It wasn't meant to be released.
Well, what I think is so interesting about it is everybody, I would think, could relate to that experience, right? Mm-hmm. Of like when you're younger and you're doing whatever you want, making bad choices, blah, blah, blah. Then there comes a time where you know that's not good for you or you don't want to be that person anymore, whatever. But there's always triggers that bring you back. Like everybody has that friend that brings them back to that place where you're like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's so, I thought it was such a clever song to talk about that and about how I can't do this anymore. I can't hang with these cool kids because they bring me back to that place. I can't be that person anymore.
It's a bit of that. I mean, also, I don't know. You guys probably don't know because it wasn't like big news over here, but I had a stalker in the UK for like 7 years who ended up breaking into my house. And I had to, you know, move out of my house. It was a big court case and it was, you know, really, it was scary. Yeah. And, you know, while my kids were there and stuff, I mean, it was really terrifying. Anyway. And, you know, he wanted to kill me. Like, that's why he was there. It was really, really scary. But after that, it affected me quite deeply psychologically. And I was very isolated and disconnected from all of my friends, all, you know, my family. I completely just, like, went into myself. And that's, you know, although it is, you know, I'm not in recovery, but, you know, I don't party like I used to. But, yeah, after this sort of, like, period of time where I was so isolated from people, when I was trying to kind of, like, re-enter, like, social scene in London, it was really hard because it was, I didn't really want to talk about this thing, but everything else just seemed so shallow and hollow in comparison to what it was that I'd experienced. And, you know, when people say, you know, how are you? You want to say, I'm really not very good. Somebody tried to kill me. But it's
nobody wants to hear that.
it's a bit intense, you know, for the pub or whatever.
Yeah, how much time do you have?
Yeah, so that's kind of what it was. It was almost like, you know, just being out in like normality was a trigger for me because I'd experienced this like really intense traumatic thing. So it was about the partying as well, but it was also just about, yeah, it was just a weird time.
It's so interesting because it shows you that everybody can take something from a song song differently.
Well, that's exactly, I always have that when I'm writing. I'm always like, I kind of have a checklist of things, and it's sort of like, you know, does this mean something to me? Yes. Is it valuable information to other people? You know, sometimes it's too personal. It can't be applied to somebody else. And, you know, and will other people be able to relate to it? And so, yeah, sometimes I'll be a little bit too descriptive about one or two things, and I'll have to pull it back because people won't be able to project themselves, you know, see themselves in the narrative.
Too specific.
Yeah.
Tonight on the show, you're going to perform Three, which I don't know if this is true. You can say, was the first song you wrote from somebody else's point of view?
Yeah, true.
And do you want? Can you talk a little bit about whose point of view?
It is a song written from the perspective of both my daughters, although it sounds like it's just from one person's perspective, but, well, it is really, but I just don't want to have to tell them which one. So it's both. But yeah, it's about, you know, them being confused about their mum having to leave the whole time, you know, and it's, you know, written from the perspective of a 3-year-old child.
Was that a hard thing to do after? I mean, I'm sure it was, but like when you have little children, but you're still on the road, like, and they can't always come with you. Like, it must be so hard to leave them.
Yeah, I think what's,
is that what inspired
it's really hard, like, on a selfish level, just because I love spending time with them. But also, it's just difficult to, like, articulate it, you know? Like, right. When you're 3 and your mum's going, I love you, I love you, I love you so much, like, smothering, you know, them almost with love. And then 5 minutes later, like, goodbye.
Yeah.
Right.
That's like really weird thing for a child to compute. It's like, but you just said you loved me. And I think that, you know,
did they say that to you?
No, they didn't. But, you know, I internalized a lot of stuff as a kid. So I just assume that my kids will be doing the same thing. But, you know, I just think I have to be really careful with like how much I tell them I love them, because I'm not there the whole time. And I think when you're that young, if somebody's, you know, showering you with stuff and then 10 minutes later they're gone, you must think, what have I done wrong? Because
where are you?
Well, where, what else would you think?
When they're a little older, you can put them in the band.
Yeah. Well, they don't have a concert. They don't understand like what money is or what, like why you have to go.
Why you have to leave. Yeah. But I think that probably makes for a great parent, that you're able to have that perspective to help them and see it from that point of view, because I don't think a lot of people even think about that.
Right. A lot of people are oblivious that they're even, that they
I
may
think
feel
that's a very sensitive perspective to have in a good way.
Good mom.
Yeah.
And then I was going to talk about Family Man, which you worked on with Mark Ronson, who you worked with before. We love Mark Ronson. What I love about that song is it kind of flips the roles. Like can you talk a little bit about that song? And
yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, on the last record, when I was touring, I kind of was touring to excess, shall we say, and living the, you know, rock and roll lifestyle, but like the sort of stereotypical like male rock star lifestyle, you know, the like what happens on tour stays on tour, like, yeah, anyway, that was me, and it was great and it was fun, but not really, I don't know, maybe men feel like better about like returning home and keeping a lid on that stuff. I personally couldn't. I was like, I was just rid with guilt and shame, and yeah, and it was annoying to me because, you know, when I'm on tour with like 25 guys who are all married and all have kids and all do exactly the same thing, and they've got no problem behaving like that and going, not all of them, by the way, just in case any of their wives are listening. But yeah, I mean, it happens, you know, and I was interested in that dynamic of like, you know, why do I mean,
yeah,
it's just such an interesting play on words.
Listen to the song.
It's great.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, we have a great number of authors and novelists and sort of thinkers on our show as guests, and Seth is always interested in finding out who they read or who they listen to or who they're inspired by when they're not focused on their own project. Mm-hmm. So I wondered, when you're not performing or writing, are there certain artists that you find yourself coming back to or continuously inspired by, especially as of late, in the last, like when you were maybe working on this or what you listen to in your
leisure? Not really. Especially when I'm writing, I'm really self-involved. Like, okay. I pretty much only listen to myself. And I write a lot, you know, in my diaries and stuff or my notebooks, and I just reread stuff to try and get, I mean, I really am, you know, and then I'm on my Twitter feed looking at my mentions, very self-obsessed person. But I mean, I guess, you know, I also like purposefully don't, I mean, I'll listen to the greats. So I'll listen to like Blossom Dearie and Ella Fitzgerald and you know, like the Stone Roses or Happy Mondays, you know, whatever from the past. But I tend not really to want to listen to anything current because I just don't want to be led by it. I don't want to be like, this is what's working on the radio, so I've got to make music that sounds like this. So I try, and also because I'm like such a codependent person and I will copy people, you know, for success, that I can't, I know that I can't listen to it because it's like, I just can't help. I also don't have a lot of like self-confidence. So it's like, I never think anything that I do is good enough. So, you know, if I hear something that that's current and really good, I'm just like, ugh.
You still feel like that now?
I'll just do that.
So when you still go do a show, like you're going to play a music hall at Williamsburg tonight, when those fans are singing your songs back to you, it's like, it still feels like like in the beginning, like you can't believe it.
Yeah. I mean, I just think, I don't know. I just think like, what are you guys like? You don't know how much of an idiot I am.
That's amazing.
I'm like, I always just think like, I can't believe like I managed to get, you know, 500 people like to buy tickets to come here. It's insane. Yeah, why?
Well, there will be a lot of people cheering for you tonight on the show when you perform, and we're really thrilled to have you here.
Yeah.
So hopefully you'll come back.
Yay. Thanks, Lily.
Thank you. Thanks.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.